ahead and then two left turns. The car drove through, followed these directions, and stopped in front of a stone building. "Here we are," said the major. They got out, and a sergeant saluted the major and opened the door. The major returned his salute, and handed him an order with a colonel's signature at the bottom, an order to consign to the bearer 5 Tommy guns, 20 rifles, 20 revolvers, and the necessary ammunition. "We're expecting a terrorist attack," the major explained condescendingly. "Goddamn terrorists," muttered the sergeant. "We've no time to lose," the major added. "Can you hurry?" "Of course, sir," said the sergeant. "I quite understand." He pointed out the arms and ammunition to the 3 soldiers, who silently and quickly loaded them onto the truck. In a very few minutes it was all done. "I'll just keep this order, sir," said the sergeant, as the visitor started to go away. "Right you are, sergeant," said the major, climbing into the truck. The sentry was just about to open the gate when, in his sentry box, the telephone rang. With a hasty apology, he went to answer. The major and his men waited impatiently. "Sorry, sir," said the sentry as he emerged from the box. "The sergeant wants to see you. He says the order you brought him is not satisfactory." The major got down from the truck. "I'll clear it up with him on the telephone," he said. As the sentry turned around to re-enter the box, the major brought his fist down on the back of his neck. The sentry fell noiselessly to the ground. The guard went over to the gate, opened it, and signaled to the driver to go through. Just then the sentry came to and started shooting. Dan put a bullet into his belly, while guard jumped onto the truck and called out, "Let's go, and hurry!" The wounded sentry continued to shoot, and one of his bullets punctured a tire. Guard retained his self-possession and decided that the tire must be changed. "David and Dan, keep us covered," he said in a quiet, assured voice. David and Dan grabbed 2 of the recently received Tommy guns and stood by. By now the whole camp was alerted. Orders rang out and gunfire followed. Every second was precious. Covered by David and Dan, Gad changed the tire. But the paratroopers were drawing near. Gad knew that the important thing was to make off with the weapons. "David and Dan," he said, "stay where you are. We're leaving. See if you can hold them back for 3 minutes longer while we get away. After that you can make a dash for it. Try to get to Gidera, where friends will give you shelter. You know where to find them."
"Yes, I know," said David, continuing to shoot.
"Go on and hurry." The arms and ammunition were saved. But David and Dan had to pay. Dan was killed, and David wounded. All on account of a stubbornly courageous sentry with a bullet in his belly.
"He was a wonderful fellow, David," said Ilana. Already she spoke of him as if he belonged to the past.
"I hope the hangman knows it," retorted Gad.
I understood his bitterness. Indeed, I envied it. He was losing a friend, and it hurt. But when you lose a friend every day, it doesn't hurt so much. And I'd lost plenty of friends in my time. Sometimes I thought of myself as a living graveyard. That was the real reason I followed Gad to Palestine and became a terrorist. I had no more friends to lose.
"They say that the hangman always wears a mask," said Joab, who had been standing silently in front of the kitchen door. "I wonder if it's true."
"I think it is," I said. "The hangman wears a mask. You can't see anything but his eyes." Ilana went over to Gad, stroked his hair, and said in a sad voice, "Don't torture yourself, Gad. This is war."
During the hour that followed, nobody said a word. They were all thinking of David Ben Moshe. David was not alone in his death cell. His friends were with him, all except me. I did not think of David except when they pronounced his name. When they were silent, my thoughts went out to someone else, to a man I didn't yet know, any more than I knew David, but whom I was fated to know. My David Ben Moshe had the name and face of an Englishman, Captain John Dawson. We sat around the table, and Ilana served us some steaming tea. For some time we sipped it without speaking. We looked into the golden liquid in our cups, as if we were searching in it for the next step after our silence and the meaning of the events which had brought it about. Then, in order to kill time, we spoke of our memories, of such of them that centered on death.
"Death saved my life," Joab began.
He had a young, innocent, tormented face, dark, confused eyes, and hair as white as that of an old man. He wore a perpetually sleepy expression and yawned from one end of the day to the other.
"A neighbor who was against us because of his pacifist convictions reported me to the police," he went on. "I took shelter in an insane asylum whose superintendent was an old school friend. I stayed there for 2 weeks, until the police found my traces. 'Is he here?' they asked the superintendent. 'Yes,' he admitted. 'He's here. He's a very sick man.' 'What's the matter with him?' they asked. 'He imagines he's dead,' the superintendent told them. But they insisted on seeing me. I was brought to the superintendent's office, where two police officials assigned to the anti-terrorist campaign were waiting. They spoke to me, but I didn't answer. They asked me questions, but I pretended not to hear. Even so, they were not convinced that I was crazy. Overriding the superintendent's protest, they took me away and submitted me to 48 hours of interrogation. I played dead, and played it successfully. I refused to eat or drink. When they slapped my hands and face, I did not react. Dead men feel no pain, and so they don't cry. After 48 hours, I was taken back to the asylum." As I listened to Joab, various thoughts floated to the surface of my mind. I remembered hearing some of my comrades refer to Joab as the madman. "Funny, isn't it?" he said. "Death actually saved my life."
We kept silence for several minutes, as if to pay homage to death for saving his life and giving the name of madman to a fellow with an innocent, tormented face. Several days later, when I left the asylum, I saw that my hair had turned white, Joab concluded. "That's one of death's little jokes," I put in. "Death loves to change the color of people's hair. Death has no hair, it has only eyes. God, on the other hand, has no eyes at all."
"God saved me from death," said Gideon.
We called Gideon the saint, first because he was a saint, and second because he looked like one. He was a husky, inarticulate fellow, some 20 years old, who took pains to make himself inconspicuous and was always mumbling prayers. He wore a beard and side curls, went nowhere without a prayer book in his pocket. His father was a rabbi, and when he learned that his son meant to become a terrorist, he gave him his blessing. "There are times," his father said, "when words and prayers are not enough. The God of grace is also the God of war, and war is not a matter of mere words." "God saved me from death," Gideon repeated. "His eyes saved me. I too was arrested and tortured. They pulled my beard, lit matches under my fingernails, and spat in my face, all in order to make me confess that I had taken part in an attempt against the life of the High Commissioner. But in spite of the pain, I did not talk. More than once I was tempted to cry out, but I kept quiet, because I felt that God's eyes were upon me. 'God is looking at me,' I said to myself, 'and I must not disappoint him.' My torturers never stopped shouting, but I kept my thoughts on God and on his eyes, which are drawn to human pain. For lack of evidence, they finally had to set me free. If I had admitted my guilt, I should be dead." "And then," I put in, "God would have closed his eyes." Ilana refilled our cups. "What about you, Ilana?" I asked. "What saved your life?"
"A cold in the head," she replied.
I burst out laughing, but no one else joined in. My laugh was raucous and artificial.
"A cold in the head?" I repeated.
"Yes," said Ilana quite seriously.
"The English have no description of me. They know only my voice. One day they hauled in a whole group of women, myself among them. At the police station, a sound engineer compared each one of our voices to that of the mysterious announcer of the Voice of Freedom. Thanks to the fact that I had a heavy cold, I was quickly eliminated. And four other women were detained for further questioning." Once more I was tempted to laugh, but the others were glum and silent. "A cold," I thought to myself. And in this case it turned out to have more practical use than either faith or courage. Next we all looked at God, who was almost crushing his teacup between his fingers.
"I owe my life to three Englishmen," he said.
With his head almost on his right shoulder and his eyes fixed on the cup, he seemed to be addressing the rapidly cooling tea.
"It was very early in the game," he went on. "For reasons that no longer matter, the old man had ordered three hostages taken. They were all sergeants, and I was assigned to kill one of them, anyone. The choice was up to me. I was young then, about the age of Elisha, and suffered great mental agony from having this unwanted role thrust upon me. I was willing to play the executioner, but not the judge. Unfortunately, during the night I lost contact with the old man and couldn't explain my reluctance. The sentence had to be carried out at dawn, and how was I to choose the victim? Finally, I had an idea. I went down to the cellar and told the three sergeants that the choice was up to them. 'If you don't make it,' I said, 'then all three of you will be shot.' They decided to draw lots, and when dawn came, I put a bullet in the unlucky fellow's neck."
Involuntarily I looked at God's hands and face. The familiar hands and face of my friend, who had put a bullet in the neck of a fellow human being, and now talked coldly, almost indifferently about it. Was the sergeant's face gazing up at him from his cup of golden cool tea?
"What if the sergeants had refused to settle it among themselves?" I asked. "What then?"
God squeezed the cup harder than ever, almost as if he were trying to break it.
"I think I'd have killed myself instead," he said in a flat voice.
And after a moment of heavy silence he added,
"I tell you, I was young and very weak."
All eyes turned toward me, in expectation of my story. I gulped down a mouthful of bitter tea and wiped the perspiration off my forehead.
"I owe my life to a laugh," I said. "It was during one winter at Buchenwald. We were clothed in rags, and hundreds of people died of cold every day. In the morning we had to leave our barracks and wait outside in the snow for as long as 2 hours until they had been cleaned. One day I felt so sick that I was sure the exposure would kill me, and so I stayed behind, in hiding. Quite naturally I was discovered, and the cleaning squad dragged me before one of the many assistant barracks leaders. Without stopping to question me, he caught hold of my throat and said dispassionately, 'I'm going to choke you.' His powerful hands closed in on my throat, and in my enfeebled condition, I didn't even try to put up a fight. 'Very well,' I said to myself, 'it's all over.' I felt the blood gather in my head, and my head swell to several times its normal size, so that I must have looked like a caricature, a miserable clown. I was sure from one minute to the next that it would burst into a thousand shreds like a child's toy balloon. At this moment the assistant leader took a good look at me and found the sight so comical that he released his grip and burst out laughing. He laughed so long that he forgot his intention to kill, and that's how I got out of it, unharmed. It's funny, isn't it, that I should owe my life to an assassin's sense of humor?"
I expected my listeners to scrutinize my head to see if it had really returned to its normal size. But they did nothing of the sort. They continued to stare into their stone cold tea. In the next minutes, nobody opened his mouth. We had no more desire to call up the past, or to listen to our fellows tell their troubled life stories. We sat in restless silence around the table. Every one of us, I am sure, was asking himself to what he really owed his life. Gideon was the first to speak.
"We ought to take the Englishman something to eat," he said.
"Yes," I said to myself, "Gideon is sad, too. He's thinking of John Dawson. He must be. It's inevitable." "I don't imagine he's hungry," I said aloud. "You can't expect a man condemned to die to have an appetite." And to myself I added, "Or a man condemned to kill, either." There must have been a strange tone in my voice, for the others raised their heads and I felt the puzzled quality of their penetrating stares. "No," I said stubbornly, "a man condemned to die can't be hungry." They didn't stir, but sat petrified as the seconds dragged interminably by. "The condemned man's traditional last meal is a joke," I said loudly, "a joke in the worst possible taste, an insult to the corpse that he is about to be. What does a man care if he dies with an empty stomach?" The expression of astonishment lingered in Gad's eyes, but Elana looked at me with compassion and Gideon with friendliness. Joab did not look at me at all. His eyes were lowered, but perhaps that was his way of looking out of them.
"He doesn't know," remarked Gideon.
"He doesn't know what?" I asked, without any conscious reason for raising my voice. Perhaps I wanted to hear myself shout, to arouse my anger and see it reflected in emotionless shadows in the mirror and on the wall. Or perhaps out of sheer weakness. I felt powerless to change anything, least of all myself, in spite of the fact that I wanted to introduce a transformation into the room, to reorder the whole of creation. I would have made the saint into a madman, have given John Dawson's name to God and his fate to David. But I knew there was nothing I could do. To have such power, I should have had to take the place of death, not just of the individual death of John Dawson, the English captain, who had no more appetite than I.
"What doesn't he know?" I repeated stridently. "He doesn't know he's going to die," said Gideon in a sorrowfully dreamy voice.
"His stomach knows," I retorted. "A man about to die listens only to his stomach. He pays no attention to his heart or to his past, or to yours for that matter. He doesn't even hear the voice of the storm. He listens to his stomach. And his stomach tells him that he is going to die and that he isn't hungry." I had talked too fast and too loud, and I was left panting. I should have liked to run away, but my friend's stares transfixed me. Death sealed off every exit, and everywhere there were eyes.
"I'm going down to the cellar," said Gideon. "I'll ask him if he wants something to eat."
"Don't ask him anything," I said. "Simply tell him that tomorrow, when the sun rises above the blood-red horizon, he, John Dawson, will say goodbye to life, goodbye to his stomach. Tell him that he's going to die." Gideon got up, with his eyes still on me, and started toward the kitchen and the entrance to the cellar. At the door he paused.
"I'll tell him," he said, with a quickly fading smile. Then he turned on his heels, and I heard him going down the stairs.
I was grateful for his consent. He, and not I, would warn John Dawson of his approaching end. I could never have done it. It's easier to kill a man than to break the news that he's going to die.
"Midnight," said Joab.
Midnight, I reflected.
the hour when the dead rise out of their grave and come to say their prayers in the synagogue, the hour when God himself weeps over the destruction of the temple, the hour when a man should be able to plumb the depths of his being and to discover the temple in ruins. A God that weeps, and dead men that pray. "Poor boy," murmured Elana. She didn't look at me, but her tears scrutinized my face. Her tears, rather than her eyes, caressed me. "Don't say that, Elana. Don't call me poor boy." There were tears in her eyes, or rather, there were tears in the place of her eyes. Tears which with every passing second grew heavier and more opaque and threatened to overflow. I was afraid that suddenly the worst would happen. The dusky Elana would no longer be there. She would have drowned in her tears. I wanted to touch her arm and say, "Don't cry. Say what you like, but don't cry." But she wasn't crying. It takes eyes to cry. And she had no eyes, only tears where her eyes should have been. "Poor boy," she repeated. Then what I had foreseen came true. Elana disappeared, and Catherine was there instead. I wondered why Catherine had come, but her apparition did not particularly surprise me. She liked the opposite sex, and particularly she liked little boys who were thinking of death. She liked to speak of love to little boys, and since men going to their death are little boys, she liked to speak to them of love. For this reason her presence in the magical room, magical because it transcended the differences, the boundary lines between the victim and the executioner, between the present and the past, was not surprising. I had met Catherine in Paris in 1945, when I had just come from Buchenwald, that other magical spot where the living were transformed into dead and their future into darkness. I was weakened and half-starved. One of the many rescue committees sent me to a camp where 100 boys and girls were spending their summer vacation. The camp was in Normandy, where the early morning breeze rustled the same way it did in Palestine. Because I knew no French, I couldn't communicate with the other boys and girls. I ate and sunbathed with them, but I had no way of talking. Catherine was the only person who seemed to know any German, and occasionally we exchanged a few words. Sometimes she came up to me at the dining-room table and asked me whether I had slept well, enjoyed my meal, or had a good time during the day. She was 26 or 27 years old. Small, frail, and almost transparent, with silky, blonde, sunlit hair and blue, dreamy eyes which never cried. Her face was thin, but saved from being bony by the delicacy of the features. She was the first woman I had seen from nearby. Before this, that is, before the war, I didn't look at women. On my way to school or the synagogue, I walked close to the walls with my eyes cast down on the ground. I knew that women existed, and why, but I didn't appreciate the fact that they had a body. Breasts, legs, hands, and lips whose touch sets a man's heart to beating. Catherine revealed this to me. The camp was at the edge of a wood, and after supper I went walking there all by myself, talking to the murmuring breeze and watching the sky turn a deeper and deeper blue. I liked to be alone. One evening, Catherine asked if she might go with me, and I was too timid to say anything but yes. For half an hour, we walked, in complete silence. At first I found the silence embarrassing, then to my surprise I began to enjoy it. The silence of two people is deeper than the silence of one. Involuntarily I began to talk. "Look how the sky is opening up," I said.
She threw back her head and looked above her. Just as I had said, the sky was opening up. Slowly at first, as if swept by an invisible wind, the stars drew away from the zenith, some moving to the right, others to the left, until the center of the sky was an empty space, dazzlingly blue, and gradually acquiring depth and outline. "Look hard," I said. "There's nothing there." From behind me, Catherine looked up and said not a word. "That's enough," I said. "Let's go on walking." As we walked on, I told her the legend of the open sky. When I was a child, the old master told me that there were nights when the sky opened up in order to make way for the prayers of unhappy children. On one such night, a little boy whose father was dying said to God, "Father, I am too small to know how to pray, but I ask you to heal my sick father." God did what the boy asked. But the boy himself was turned into a prayer and carried up into heaven. From that day on, the master told me, God has from time to time shown himself to us in the face of a child. "That's why I like to look at the sky at this particular moment," I told Catherine. "I hope to see the child." "But you are a witness to the truth. There's nothing there. The child is only a story." It was then for the first time during the evening that Catherine spoke. "Poor boy," she exclaimed. "Poor boy." "She's thinking of the boy in the story," I said to myself, and I loved her for her compassion. After this, Catherine often went walking with me. She questioned me about my childhood and my more recent past, but I didn't always answer. One evening she asked me why I kept apart from the other boys and girls in the camp. "Because they speak a language I can't understand," I told her. "Some of the girls know German," she said, "but I have nothing to say to them." "You don't have to say anything," she said slowly, with a smile. "All you have to do is love them." I didn't see what she was driving at, and said so. Her smile widened, and she began to speak to me of love. She spoke easily and well. "Love is this, and love is that. Man is born to love. He is only alive when he is in the presence of a woman he loves or should love." I told her that I knew nothing of love, that I didn't know it existed, or had a right to exist. "I'll prove it to you," she said. The next evening, as she walked at my left side over the leaf-covered path, she took hold of my arm. At first I thought she needed my support, but actually it was because she wanted to make me feel the warmth of her body. Then she claimed to be tired and said it would be pleasant to sit down on the grass under a tree. Once we had sat down, she began to stroke my face and hair. Then she kissed me, several times. First her lips touched mine, and then her tongue burned the inside of my mouth. For several nights running we returned to the same place, and she spoke to me of love and desire and the mysteries of the heart. She took my hand and guided it over her breasts and thighs, and I realized that women had breasts and thighs and hands that could set a man's heart to beating and turn his blood to fire. "Poor boy," said Ilana, in a very quiet voice for the last time. And a deep sigh escaped from her breast, which made her tears free to flow on and on, until the end of time. Suddenly, I became aware that the room was stuffy, so stuffy that I was almost stifled. No wonder, the room was small, far too small to receive so many visitors at one time. Ever since midnight, the visitors had been pouring in. Among them were people I had known, people I had hated, admired, forgotten. As I let my eyes wander about the room, I realized that all of those who had contributed to my formation, to the formation of my permanent identity, were there. Some of them were familiar, but I couldn't pin a label upon them. They were names without faces, or faces without names. And yet I knew that at some point my life had crossed theirs. My father was there, of course, and my mother, and the beggar, and the grizzled master. The English soldiers of the convoy we had ambushed at Gedera were there also. And around them, friends and brothers and comrades, some of them out of my childhood, others that I had seen live and suffer, hope and curse at Buchenwald and Auschwitz. Alongside my father there was a boy who looked strangely like myself, as I had been before the concentration camps, before the war, before everything. My father smiled at him, and the child picked up the smile and sent it to me over the multitude of heads which separated us. Now I understood why the room was so stuffy. It was too small to hold so many people at a time. I forced a passage through the crowd until I came to the little boy and thanked him for the smile. I wanted to ask him what all these people were doing in the room, but on second thought I saw that this would be discourteous toward my father. Since he was present, I should address my question to him. "Father, why are all these people here?" My mother stood beside him, looking very pale, and her lips tirelessly murmured, "Poor little boy, poor little boy." "Father," I repeated, "answer me, what are you all doing here?" His large eyes, in which I had so often seen the sky open up, were looking at me, but he didn't reply. I turned around and found myself face to face with the rabbi, whose beard was more grizzled than ever. "Master," I said, "what has brought all these people here tonight?" Behind me I heard my mother whisper, "Poor little boy, my poor little boy." "Well, master," I repeated, "answer me, I implore you." But he didn't answer either. Indeed, he seemed not even to have heard my question, and his silence made me afraid. As I had known him before, he was always present in my hour of need. Then his silence had been reassuring. Now I tried to look into his eyes, but they were two globes of fire, two suns that burned my face. I turned away and went from one visitor to another, seeking an answer to my question, but my presence struck them dumb. Finally, I came to the beggar, who stood head and shoulders above them all, and he spoke to me quite spontaneously. "This is a night of many faces," he said. I was sad and tired. "Yes," I said wearily, "this is a night of many faces, and I should like to know the reason why. If you are the one I think you are, enlighten and comfort me. Tell me the meaning of these looks, this muteness, these presences. Tell me, I beseech you, for I can endure them no longer." He took my arm, gently pressed it, and said, "Do you see that little boy over there?" And he pointed to the boy who looked like myself as I had been. "Yes, I see him," I replied. "He will answer all your questions," said the beggar. "Go, talk to him." Now I was quite sure that he was not a beggar. Once more I elbowed my way through the crowd of ghosts and arrived, panting with exhaustion, at the young boy's side. "Tell me," I said beseechingly, "what are you doing here, and all the others?" He opened his eyes, wide in astonishment. "Don't you know?" he asked. I confessed that I didn't know. "Tomorrow a man is to die, isn't he?" "Yes," I said, "at dawn tomorrow." "And you are to kill him, aren't you?" "Yes, that's true. I have been charged with his execution." "And you don't understand, do you?" No.
But it's all quite simple, he exclaimed. We are here to be present at the execution. We want to see you carry it out. We want to see you turn into a murderer. That's natural enough, isn't it?
How is it natural? Of what concern is the killing of John Dawson to you?
You are the sum total of all that we have been, said the youngster, who looked like my former self. In a way, we are the ones to execute John Dawson, because you can't do it without us. Now, do you see?
I was beginning to understand. An act so absolute as that of killing involves not only the killer, but, as well, those who have formed him. In murdering a man, I was making them murderers.
Well, said the boy, do you see?
Yes, I see, I said.
Poor boy. Poor boy,
murmured my mother, whose lips were now as gray as the old master's hair.
He's hungry, said Gideon's voice unexpectedly. I hadn't heard him come back up the stairs. Saints have a disconcertingly noiseless way. They walk, laugh, eat, and pray, all without making a sound.
Impossible, I protested.
He can't be hungry, I was thinking. He's going to die, and a man who's going to die can't be hungry.
He said so himself, Gideon insisted, with a shade of emotion in his voice.
Everyone was staring at me.
Ilana had stopped crying, Joab was no longer examining his nails, and Gad looked weary. All the ghosts, too, seemed to be expecting something of me, a sign, perhaps, or a cry.
"Does he know?" I asked Gideon.
"Yes, he knows."
And after a moment he added, "I told him."
How did he react?
It was important for me to know the man's reaction. Was the news a shock? Had he stayed calm or protested his innocence?
"He smiled," said Gideon. "He said that he already knew. His stomach had told him."
"And he said he was hungry?"
Gideon hid his twitching hands behind his back.
"Yes, that's what he said. He said he was hungry and he had a right to a good last meal."
Gad laughed, but the tone of his laugh was hollow.
"Typically English," he remarked. "The stiff upper lip."
His remark hung over our heads in midair. No one opened up to receive it. My father shot me a hard glance as if to say, "A man is going to die, and he's hungry."
"Might as well admit it," said Gad. "The English have iron digestions."
No one paid any attention to this remark either. I felt a sudden stab of pain in my stomach. I hadn't eaten all day. Ilana got up and went into the kitchen.
"I'll fix him something to eat," she declared.
I heard her moving about, slicing a loaf of bread, opening the icebox, starting to make coffee. In a few minutes she came back with a cup of coffee in one hand and a plate in the other.
"This is all I can find," she said. "A cheese sandwich and some black coffee. There's no sugar. Not much of a meal, but it's the best I can do."
And after several seconds of silence she asked,
"Who's going to take it down?"
The boy standing beside my father stared hard at me. His stare had a voice which said, "Go on, take him something to eat. He's hungry, you know."
"No," I responded, "not I. I don't want to see him. Above all, I don't want to see him eat. I want to think of him later on as a man who never ate."
I wanted to add that I had cramps in my stomach, but I realized that this was unimportant. Instead, I said, "I don't want to be alone with him, not now."
"We'll go with you," said the little boy. It's wrong to hold back food from a man who's hungry. You know that.
Yes, I knew. I had always given food to the hungry. You, beggar, you remember. Didn't I offer you bread? But tonight is different. Tonight I can't do it.
That's true, said the little boy, picking up the train of my reflections. Tonight is different, and you are different also, or at least you're going to be. But that has nothing to do with the fact that a man's hungry and must have something to eat.
But he's going to die tomorrow, I protested. What's it matter whether he dies with a full stomach or an empty one?
For the time being, he's alive, the child said sententiously. My father nodded in acquiescence, and all the others followed his example.
He's alive and hungry, and you refuse to give him anything to eat?
All these heads, nodding like the tops of black trees, made me shudder. I wanted to close my eyes, but I was ashamed. I couldn't close my eyes in the presence of my father.
Very well, I said resignedly. I accept. I'll take him something to eat.
As if obeying the baton of an invisible conductor, the nodding heads were still.
"I'll take him something to eat," I repeated. "But first tell me something, little boy. Are the dead hungry, too?"
He looked surprised.
"What? You don't know?" he exclaimed. "Of course they are."
"And should we give them something to eat?"
"How can you ask? Of course you should give them something to eat. Only it's difficult, 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 difficult," the ghosts echoed together.
The boy looked at me and smiled.
"I'll tell you a secret," he whispered. "You know that at midnight the dead leave their graves, don't you?"
I told him that I knew. I had been told.
"Have you been told that they go from the graveyard to the synagogue?"
"Yes, I had been told that also."
"Well, it's true," said the little boy.
Then, after a silence which accentuated what was to follow, he went on in a voice so still that if it had not been inside myself, I could never have heard it.
"Yes, it's true. They gather every night in the synagogue, but not for the purpose you imagine. They come not to pray, but to eat."
Everything in the room, walls, chairs, heads, began to whirl around me, dancing in a pre-established rhythm, without stirring the air or setting foot on the ground. I was the center of a multitude of circles. I wanted to close my eyes and stop up my ears, but my father was there, and my mother, and the master, and the beggar, and the boy. With all those who had formed me around me, I had no right to stop up my ears and close my eyes.
"Give me those things," I said to Ilana. "I'll take them to him."
The dancers stopped in their tracks, as if I were the conductor and my words his baton. I stepped toward Ilana, still standing at the kitchen door. Suddenly God rushed forward and reached her side before me. "I'll do it," he said. Almost brutally, he snatched the cup and plate from Ilana's hands and went precipitately down the stairs. Joab looked at his watch.
"It's after 2.
"Is that all?" asked Ilana.
"It's a long night, the longest I've ever lived through."
"Yes, it's long," Joab agreed.
Ilana bit her lips. "There are moments when I think it will never end, that it will last indefinitely. It's like the rain. Here the rain, like everything else, suggests permanence and eternity. I say to myself, it's raining today, and it's going to rain tomorrow and the next day, the next week and the next century. Now I say to myself, there's night now, and there will be night tomorrow, and the day, the week, the century after." She paused abruptly, took a handkerchief from the cuff of her blouse, and wiped her perspiring forehead.
"I wonder why it's so stuffy in here," she said, "particularly this late at night."
"It'll be cooler early tomorrow,"
promised Joab. I hope so, said Ilana. What time does the sun rise?
Around 5 o'clock.
And what time is it now?
2:20, said Joab, looking again at his watch.
Aren't you hot, Elisha?
Ilana asked me.
Yes, I am, I answered.
Ilana went back to her place at the table. I walked over to the window and looked out. The city seemed far away and unreal. Deep in sleep, it spawned anxious dreams, hopeful dreams, dreams which would proliferate other dreams on the morrow. And these dreams in their turn would engender new heroes who would live through the night and prepare to die at dawn, to die and to give death.
Yes, I'm hot, Ilana, I said. I'm stifling. I don't know how long I stood sweating beside the open window before a warm, vibrant, reassuring hand was laid on my shoulder. It was Ilana. What are you thinking? She said. I'm thinking of the night, I told her. Always the same thing. And of John Dawson? Yes, of John Dawson. Somewhere in the city, a light shone in a window and then went out. No doubt a man had looked at his watch, or a mother had gone to find out whether her child was smiling in his sleep.
You didn't want to see him, though, said Ilana.
I don't want to see him. One day I was thinking, my son will say, all of a sudden you look sad, what's wrong? It's because in my eyes there is a picture of an English captain called John Dawson, just as he appeared to me at the moment of his death. Perhaps I ought to put a mask on his face. A mask is more easily killed and forgotten.
Are you afraid? Asked Ilana.
Yes.
Being afraid, I ought to have told her, is nothing. Fear is only a color, a backdrop, a landscape. That isn't the problem. The fear of either the victim or the executioner is unimportant. What matters is the fact that each of them is playing a role which has been imposed upon him. The two roles are the extremities of the estate of man. The tragic thing is the imposition.
You, Elisha, you are afraid?
I knew why she had asked. You, Elisha, who lived through Auschwitz and Buchenwald, you who any number of times saw God die, you are afraid?
I am afraid, though, Ilana, I repeated.
She knew quite well that fear was not in fact the real theme. Like death, it is only a backdrop, a bit of local color.
What makes you afraid?
Her warm, living hand was still on my shoulder. Her breasts brushed me, and I could feel her breath on my neck. Her blouse was wet with perspiration, and her face distraught. She doesn't understand, I thought to myself. I'm afraid he'll make me laugh, I said. You see, Ilana, he's quite capable of swelling up his head and letting it burst into a thousand shreds just in order to make me laugh. That's what makes me afraid. But still she didn't understand. She took the handkerchief from her cuff and wiped my neck and temples. Then she kissed my forehead lightly and said, "You torture yourself too much, Elisha. Hostages aren't clowns. There's nothing so funny about them." Poor Ilana. Her voice was as pure as truth, as sad as purity. But she didn't understand. She was distracted by the externals and didn't see what lay behind them.
"You may be right," I said in resignation. "We make them laugh. They laugh when they're dead." She stroked my face and neck and hair, and I could still feel the pressure of her breasts against my body. Then she began to talk in a sad but clear voice, as if she were talking to a sick child. "You torture yourself too much, my dear," she said several times in succession. At least she no longer called me poor boy, and I was grateful. "You mustn't do it. You're young and intelligent, and you've suffered quite enough already. Soon it will all be over. The English will get out, and we shall come back to the surface and lead a simple, normal life. You'll get married and have children. You'll tell them stories and make them laugh. You'll be happy because they're happy, and they will be happy, I promise you. How could they be otherwise with a father like you? You'll have forgotten this night, this room, me, and everything else." As she said everything else, she traced a sweeping semicircle with her hand. I was reminded of my mother. She talked in the same moving voice and used almost the same words in the same places. I was very fond of my mother. Every evening until I was 9 or 10 years old, she put me to sleep with lullabies or stories. "There is a goat beside your bed," she used to tell me, "a goat of gold. Everywhere you go in life, the goat will guide and protect you. Even when you are grown up and very rich, when you know everything a man can know and possess all that he should possess, the goat will still be near you." "You talk as if you were my mother, Ilana," I said. My mother, too, had a harmonious voice, even more harmonious than Ilana's. Like the voice of God, it had power to dispel chaos and to impart a vision of the future which might have been mine, with the goat to guide me. The goat I had lost on the way to Buchenwald. "You're suffering," said Ilana. "That's what it means when a man speaks of his mother." "No, Ilana," I said. "At this moment, she's the one to suffer." Ilana's caresses became lighter, more remote. She was beginning to understand. A shadow fell across her face. For some time she was silent, then she joined me in looking at the hand night held out to us through the window. "War is like night," she said. "It covers everything." Yes, she was beginning to understand. I hardly felt the pressure of her fingers on my neck. "We say that ours is a holy war," she went on, "that we're struggling against something and for something, against the English and for an independent Palestine. That's what we say. But these are words. As such, they serve only to give meaning to our actions. And our actions, seen in their true and primitive light, have the odor and color of blood. This is war, we say. We must kill. There are those like you who kill with their hands, and others like me who kill with their voices, each to his own. And what else can we do? War has a code. And if you deny this, you deny its whole purpose and hand the enemy victory on a silver platter. That we can't afford. We need victory. Victory in war in order to survive. In order to remain afloat on the surface of time." She didn't raise her voice. It seemed as if she were chanting a lullaby, telling a bedtime story. There was neither passion nor despair nor even concern in her intonation. All things considered, she was quite right. We were at war. We had an ideal, a purpose,
and also an enemy who stood between us and its attainment. The enemy must be eliminated. And how? By any and all means at our command. There were all sorts of means, but they were unimportant and soon forgotten. The purpose, the end, this was all that would last. Ilana was probably correct in saying that one day I should forget this night. But the dead never forget. They would remember. In their eyes I should be forever branded a killer. There are not a thousand ways of being a killer. Either a man is one or he isn't. He can't say, I'll kill only 10 or only 26 men. I'll kill for only 5 minutes or a single day. He who has killed one man alone is a killer for life. He may choose another occupation, hide himself under another identity, but the executioner, or at least the executioner's mask, will be always with him. There lies the problem. In the influence of the backdrop of the play upon the actor. War had made me an executioner. And an executioner I would remain even after the backdrop had changed, when I was acting in another play upon a different stage. I don't want to be a killer, I said, sliding rapidly over the word as I ejected it. Who does? Said Ilana. She was still stroking my neck, but somehow I had the impression that it was not really my neck, my hair, her fingers were caressing. The noblest woman in the world would hesitate to touch the skin of a killer. Of a man who would have the label of killer his whole life long. I cast a rapid glance behind me to see if the others were still there. Gideon and Joab were dozing, with their heads pillowed on their arms, on the table. Gideon seemed, even in his sleep, to be praying. God was still in the cellar, and I wondered why he had stayed there so long. As for the ghosts, they followed the conversation, but, to my surprise, took no part in it. Ilana was silent. "What are you thinking?" I murmured. She didn't reply, and after a few minutes I posed the question again. Still there was no answer. We were both silent. And the crowd behind me, the crowd of petrified silences, whose shadows absorbed the light and turned it into something sad, funereal, hostile, was silent as well. The sum of these silences filled me with fear. Their silences were different from mine. They were hard, cold, immobile, lifeless, incapable of change.